First, we're in uncharted territory as state and federal governments work to figure out how to handle the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. Many governments, including here in Wisconsin, have issued guidance for people to remain home except for essential travel. But establishing best practices to ensure everyone's protection and to make sure some groups are not unfairly targeted still haven't been set in stone. This could leave some people, like immigrants, people of color, people in poverty, and more at a disadvantage. Our next guest joins us to talk about how outbreaks like this hit these vulnerable populations especially hard, and what we and our governments can do to safeguard our neighbors in need. Emily Benfer is a visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and a health justice advocate. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. How are you?
Good. Well, you and a colleague recently, Emily, wrote about the coronavirus pandemic and how it affects different groups. Take us back to pre-pandemic and talk about some of the disparities there that are maybe put into relief by a crisis like this.
Well, for a long time, we've had disparities in health among low-income populations. There's approximately 38.1 million people who live in poverty. That's 11.8% of the population. And there is a direct connection between poverty and status as a marginalized group and poor health outcomes that we're seeing really increasing now. In fact, the lower a person's socioeconomic status, the more limited their resources and their ability to access essential goods and services. So this means they have a greater chance of chronic disease like heart disease or lung disease and other things that increase the mortality risk of COVID-19.
Then let's take it to some of the restrictions currently in place in many states of movement. What does that mean for someone from, say, a low-income group? What does that mean for them if they have this stay-at-home order, if it's harder to get around and get access to basic services, even like food, which we're generally allowed to go out and do?
Right. So this social distancing response, it's really a challenge to try and mitigate the negative effects on poor and marginalized communities, because social distancing and sheltering in place, which are the key strategies, can be really challenging for people who are low income to do when they can't take time off of work, where they are living in crowded conditions, and where they don't have the ability to shelter in place.
And you write in this piece that for some people, very low income people, their housing itself might be a health threat. Being closed up in there might actually have an adverse health outcome. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. This epidemic, it really reinforces the critical role that housing plays in either hurting or protecting our health and safety and well-being. And most states, while they have a warranty of habitability standard, they often aren't enforced in low-income settings. So we're seeing conditions in housing that could pose great risk to people who are in low-income settings, like poor air quality or mold, asbestos, lead paint, or infestations. There are 35 million, which is 40% of homes in metropolitan areas that have one or more safety hazards. And there's a greater prevalence in rental properties. So where we are asking low-income people to shelter in place may actually be very dangerous for their health and increase the rate of needing emergency department care or emergency response. In fact, of the people who are sheltering in place, 2 million live in homes without heat, hot water, electricity, or that have structural defects. And not all of those states have actually ordered a utility shutoff freeze. So we're seeing a real deficit in the ability to stay safe while complying with the public health response.
Emily Benfer is with us from Columbia Law School. She's a health justice advocate. She recently wrote a piece on how the coronavirus pandemic and the measures used to try to contain it may have an adverse effect, especially on people in low-income communities, other marginalized groups. Emily, a lot of people are turning to the online world to stay connected to friends and family, to their work, to stay sane a little bit. But as we know here in Wisconsin, there are a lot of differences in access there. Can you talk about how you see that playing out?
So many people across the country do not actually have access to the internet or to Wi-Fi services. Fortunately, Comcast recently announced that they will be providing free Wi-Fi and internet during the pandemic to try and increase the rate that people have connection and access and can work at home. PSC in Wisconsin is actually offering low or no cost broadband with a $24 million state grant. Prior to the freeze on utility shutoffs, there were 1,481 families and households in Wisconsin without electricity, though. So you can see that this disparity existed beforehand, and COVID-19 is really bringing to the forefront all of these unmet needs and this crisis across the country, and demonstrating that socially disadvantaged people are much more vulnerable to the effects of COVID-19 and to the fallout that will happen after we've recovered from this crisis as well.
I've focused questions so far on low-income people. Who are some of the other groups that you might see being especially vulnerable during this time?
So really, it's anyone with a lower socioeconomic status, also people who have a greater chance of chronic disease, who have a higher increase of mortality risk related to COVID-19, and people who have less control over their environment and few alternatives to substandard housing. It's also exacerbated for people of color who are subjected to the consequences of discrimination and segregation in housing. So we're seeing this across every group that's traditionally been marginalized. And these are the same groups that have historically borne the brunt of infectious disease epidemics and the government responses to them. And we think that with a proactive approach that's really rooted in a commitment to health justice, that we could ensure that things are finally different with COVID-19. But it also extends to immigration, to people who are in prison, where they cannot safely quarantine or shelter in place, and they will risk the effects of this long into the future.
Emily Benfer is with us, visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and health justice advocate. She's with us to talk about how vulnerable populations will be impacted the most by the ongoing coronavirus outbreak and the measures that are out there to deal with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you in one of these groups that doesn't have access to safe and healthy housing? Do you live worried that your utilities might be cut off, or you might be evicted? Do you not have access to broadband that might otherwise let you stay connected to friends, family, and work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the coronavirus pandemic and the impact it could have on communities that already faced health risks because of poverty or other factors. Emily Benfer is with us, visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and health justice advocate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there steps you'd like to see at the local, state, or federal level to help protect vulnerable groups? What questions do you have about this issue? How are you being affected that other people might not think about? If you are in a low-income community, does stay-at-home mean something different for you than it might for someone else? Is work from home not a possibility for you? If you rely on certain medications, medical treatments, is it harder to get access to them right now? Call 800-642-1234. Emily, we've just hit a few of the problems you raised in your piece, but I want to get to some of the solutions you and your colleague offer. What for you would be some priorities you'd like to see from federal and state governments?
I'm so glad you asked. One thing that I'd really love to focus on, especially in Wisconsin, is the moratorium on eviction. So across the country, we've seen a number of state courts order that state courthouses across that area not take any eviction filings throughout the pandemic, that there is ultimately a freeze on eviction filings throughout these states. And right now, there are 30 states who have suspended those cases. Wisconsin is not one of them. And there are only 15 states that have banned enforcement of past orders of eviction. And Wisconsin is also not one of those. In fact, Wisconsin has left suspension of eviction to local discretion. And there are a number of county circuit courts where evictions are continuing in the state of Wisconsin. And so this is an area of great urgency that we know that halting eviction can actually flatten the curve, that it can reduce the rate of infection for COVID-19, and that keeping people housed safely and not being evicted and facing that downward spiral to a worse condition and a more unstable environment can help us maintain the public health. So this is an area that is very urgent and must go through as quickly as possible. Another is nutritional supports. For a lot of people who are low income, food stamps or SNAP and women, infant, and children funding is really the only income they have to help alleviate hunger in their family. The emergency declarations have freed up a number of resources to create regulatory flexibility that allows states and local leaders to fight insecurity during this crisis. And one of those is a pandemic EBT for children who would have received free meals at school. And states get to opt into that. Wisconsin has yet to do so. So this is another area of urgent advocacy and adoption of the state, where the state can actually intervene and protect low-income populations and make sure that they have enough food and other necessities to safely shelter in place to help protect the public health.
In national politics, all eyes are on this bill that came through the Senate. Looking at the U.S. House, this emergency relief bill, stimulus bill, people are calling it different things. Do you see things in there that are going to meet some of the concerns that you're watching for?
Yes. So this 880-page bill, it provides nearly $2 trillion in financial relief as we continue to grapple with the COVID-19 crisis. It's a start. It's a step in the right direction. There is a number of emergency appropriations related to unemployment and the 34 million workers who have no paid sick leave. And it's adding more to that. Moody Analytics estimated that 80 million jobs face some level of risk because of COVID-19, and 27 million are at high risk. So this package, the Corona Relief Package, is designed to address that and get funding into the pockets of Americans as quickly as possible so there's not as much disruption as there would be otherwise. Another positive aspect, there's $12 billion to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for housing interventions. HUD has not given much guidance to public housing authorities across the country other than remote working. And so this is leaving a big gap in our housing policy. Historically, major housing policy reforms have grown out of health crises. And, you know, for example, in the 19th century, after two cholera outbreaks and concerns about high rates of contagion, we had a major housing infusion. And in the 1930s, it was the justification for public housing programs. So it is our hope that this pandemic will surface the need and urgency to really provide for safe and affordable housing across the country.
Emily Benfer is with us from Columbia Law School. We're looking at health disparities in the United States and how they're really being highlighted by the coronavirus pandemic and the response to it. Emily, that said, we're dealing with a crisis. We're kind of winging it here, trying to come up with solutions. Do you want to see more fundamental changes, even when we're not in the midst of a big crisis like this?
Absolutely. I think probably the only positive thing about COVID-19, if you could even call it positive, is that it really underscored all of the gaps in our systems, and it demonstrated for us where the safety net is unraveling, and we have to address the underlying reasons for that and to try and infuse our communities with the support that they need. And that's everything from unbiased and neutral responses, but also making sure that poverty does not carry a sentence of death and illness, especially in a pandemic. We have to redress these historical wrongs that are associated with longstanding patterns of structural inequality. And that is ultimately what achieving health justice is about. And if we can do that during this time and really support the communities that need it the most and that are at the highest risk of harm during this time, especially discriminatory enforcement and other issues, we can fare much better as a country and a society. That what's affecting low-income populations right now is affecting all of us.
We've mostly focused on things that could happen at the government level, state, federal, local, a little bit. Are there things that individual community members could be doing to look out for people, to help people out in this time where they might be being hit harder by the coronavirus epidemic?
Well, I think first and foremost, and we're hearing this everywhere, the most important thing people can do is abide by the social distancing guidelines. So sheltering in place, staying 6 feet away from each other, washing your hands constantly, and being very diligent about doing that in order to try and prevent further contagion, especially clustering. New York skyrocketed in a matter of days, and that could happen anywhere if we don't abide by those rules. And in terms of community level, I think everyone has an opportunity to contribute something here, whether it's their talents and engaging and connecting with each other, whether it's volunteering at the food pantries that really need a lot of support right now. If you stocked up on too much hand sanitizer, giving that to your neighbors, but also I think advocating on the local community level, the mayor and the sheriff's office have a lot of control over eviction and over nutritional supports and utility freezes and how that's happening on a local level. So really advocating with your local government to make sure that everyone is being protected during this time, and recognizing that if we aren't protecting everyone and giving everyone access to the necessities they need in order to comply with these recommendations, that we are ultimately all going to be injured by that if we can't move forward.
Emily, we'll keep watching to see how this develops. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm very optimistic that we will be able to recognize that how COVID-19 really underscores the importance of ensuring that all members of society benefit from and comply with these health measures. I hope everyone out there stays safe and healthy.
That's Emily Benfer, visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and a health justice advocate. She joined us today to talk about how we can protect our most vulnerable populations during the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak.